Fight the fires.
Rock them all.
Thanks for tuning in to the BAMP podcast, folks. I'm your slightly inebriated host, Mike Lafferty. And with me today, I have two of the accidental survivors, Fraser Ronald and Walt Rebilliard. How you guys doing?
I'm good.
Good, good, good.
And if you folks probably recognize Walt from, I think you've been on three or four podcasts now, haven't you, Walt?
Yeah, I'm kind of like the official, unofficial guest star, I think.
You've hitched your wagon to a star, my friend, to a star.
I have a habit of doing that.
Yeah, 10 years from now, you'll have a bit part in a Bruce Campbell movie. That's how it works.
Yeah, I'll just start looking for other employment now.
Yeah, I don't blame you. Well, hey, Fraser is the president, godfather, whatever, of Swords Edge Publishing. And they came out with Swords Noir recently, which is a big hit. And they've just came out with Kiss My Axe, which I understand is the Viking variant on that.
Absolutely, yeah. The big difference between Sword Noir and Kiss My Axe, Sword Noir kind of took sword and sorcery characters and plopped them into hard-boiled detective fiction stories, whereas Kiss My Axe goes straight for the heroic version of the Viking. The big difference, if anyone's played Sword Noir, the big difference here is in Sword Noir, combat is kind of avoided. If you read most of the hard-boiled fiction, at least the detective stuff, is very rare that the hero actually gets into fisticuffs. It's not usually the first route, and if it turns to violence, it's usually pretty quick and deadly. That doesn't work for Vikings, because you want cool combat scenes. So basically for Kiss My Axe, I pumped up the combat to make it more interesting and fun. But otherwise, the spine is the same as what you got in Sword Noir.
Okay, it's more combat heavy to reflect the ethic and nature of Vikings, as it were.
Absolutely. I mean, in again, for hard-boiled, there's a long, convoluted, complicated story that you're basically trying to unravel, whereas with Vikings, if there's a problem, they just kill it.
So it's kind of like comparing maybe your classic film noir to, say, Quentin Tarantino.
Excellent. Yeah, for sure. Or, you know what, take The Big Sleep with Humphrey Bogart for Sword Noir and take The 13th Warrior for Kiss My Axe, because the subtitle of Kiss My Axe does happen to be 13 Warriors and an Angel of Death.
Oh, sweet, sweet. And before we forget, the first adventure was just released today, and people can get up the rules and a bundle on RPG Now for less than $5 for $4.38.
That's right.
And this first adventure is called Suffer the Witch. I'm looking at it right now. It's a pretty nice layout. And you got a really cool map there at the end. I'm wondering if you did your map work there.
I'm shocked that you call it a really cool map, because that was pasted together on GIMP with a bunch of different elements from all sorts of things, from Dungeony user pieces to things cut from photos. Like the water is literally just cut out of a photo of a river. And the thing with maps, the maps in Suffer the Witch are there as almost a visualization for the person running the game. One of the things in Kiss My Axe in the back, I've got this little section called The Plays the Thing, which I wrote after Gen Con, and in that it discusses maps. I rarely use maps. I use the big maps. So Kiss My Axe kind of grew out of a True 20 Viking campaign that I've been running. And I use the big maps to show people, like, okay, this is the Baltic Sea, and this is where, like, Gotland is, and this is where Burka and these different places, Novgorod, are, that sort of thing. But when they're in Novgorod, it wasn't like I had a map of Novgorod for them to look at, or even battle maps and stuff like that. The combat in Kiss My Axe, much like in Sword Noir, is very abstract, very abstract. Things like range, it's like you're melee close. Far. Basically ranges.
So kind of icons in that way.
Yeah, exactly. There's no, so the maps that I tend not to use maps, and when, for example, people kind of need help visualizing, I'll just freehand some shit on some paper. So, actually, before I go any further, is this an explicit podcast?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Sorry.
Okay.
Cool. Let me just clear the tables. Fuck shit, goddamn pig's balls, okay?
Motherfucking shit.
Yeah. All right. So we're fine. If any kids listening now, well, just got an education, so.
Yeah. By the way, there's also drinking involved, so.
What are you guys drinking? Because I hate to say I'm drinking wine tonight.
What kind of wine are you drinking?
Oh, it's out of a box, man.
Okay, that's a shame.
Yeah, it's a shame. Well, I've been drinking Captain Morgan Private Stock straight on the rocks the last couple of days. Now it's feeling a little meager. I thought I would refortify myself with some fine Franzia boxed Chardonnay. And it's, feeling a little more put together. How about you guys?
I'm drinking an Italian blend dark roast because, unfortunately, I work with liquor, so I don't want to look at it at all when I get home.
I can understand that. I was the same way when I was going to gynecology school for a while. Fraser, what are you drinking?
I'm actually finishing off the last couple of steam whistle that I have. It's a Pilsner beer that's brewed in Toronto. And over the Christmas holidays, my cousins and I decided it may be the finest Canadian beer available.
That's a pretty impressive statement because you guys have some of the real beer up there.
Well, to be true, I used to make that joke a lot, but after having visited the States recently a few times and being able to sample some of the microbrews that are in the States, I don't make that comment anymore. The industrial stuff that you get in the States is piss poor, but then the industrial stuff we get in Canada is also piss poor. So, I mean, if anybody wanted to try, like, Canadian beer, don't try Labatt's, don't try Molson Canadian, anything like that. Like, try stuff like Steam Whistle. Moosehead is pretty widely available now, and it is our largest microbrewery. Steam Whistle or Cameron's, Sleeman's isn't even Canadian anymore. It was bought by Sapporo. So I don't make the joke about American beers anymore because some of the American beer that I tried out when I was down there was really quite good.
Where'd you go to try? Yeah.
Actually, one of my favorites turned out to be, and I was totally cold cocked by Coors, the fucking bastards, because I was enjoying Blue Moon.
Yeah.
I like Belgian White. I dig that kind of style of beer. And so when I was at Gen Con this year, I asked one of the waitresses about, you know, what have you got and everything. I mentioned what I liked, and she suggested, well, we've got Blue Moon. I tried it. You know, it's pretty good. Actually, I have to admit, I enjoyed it quite a lot, and it was widely available. And then I was in Tampa a while back, a few months back, and it was the same thing. Like, we were at we went to one of the baseball games, the Rays. And of all the shitty beer that was available there, boom, there was like some Blue Moon. So I really enjoyed that. And when I got back into Canada, I did a little bit of research and found out that it's a front for Coors.
Yeah, they kind of downplay that. They don't really emphasize that fact. But yeah, it's brewed just a few miles from where I'm sitting right now in Golden.
Exactly. I was totally taken in. But so that was kind of my go-to beer while I was there. We tried a couple of others. We went. When we were in Gen Con in Indianapolis, there was a I totally forget the name of the place, but there was like a brew pub. They made their own beer there on the site, and we tried an IPA there and just a lager. Both of them were fantastic, like just excellent. So
see, there's a couple different brew pubs. There's the Bram Brew Pub, there's Butterful Brew Pub, Rock Bottom.
This was the Rock Bottom, maybe.
Yeah, I got a buddy who actually works in one of the brew pubs in Indianapolis. It's kind of a bar back, and they just pay him in beer. So,
well, that's all right.
I'm not going to say his name because he actually makes his own beer, and he kind of has a bootleg operation on his front porch in his neighborhood. they have blue laws in Indiana on Sundays. He sells six packs of his homebrew off his front porch. But his particular neighborhood is probably more worried about the prostitutes and the crack than they are about a guy, you know, selling the occasional six pack. But
well, that's like one stop shopping. That's awesome.
You can get most of your baser urges fulfilled in that neighborhood. It's also the highest area code, zip code in Indiana for both carjacking and syphilis.
Wow. Yeah.
All right. So bring a dome, not a car.
That's just about 2 miles from Gen Con, actually.
Well, that's walkable then. No problem.
There, yeah.
Yeah, because experiencing some role-playing action for real.
Pretty modern right there, man.
It's a whole different kind of role-playing.
I could tell you stories, but hey, let's talk a little more about Stuff for the Witch, which is the first adventure for Kiss My Ex. Hey, give us the elevator pitch. What happens in this adventure?
So basically, the group, who are, we're assuming, a war band of Vikings, find themselves lost, stranded, in whatever fashion you would like, by this village. And the village has been suffering under the curse of a witch for an extended period of time. And the chieftain, the headman at the village, basically says that he's lost all these men trying to remove this witch, and he's unwilling to lose anymore. And that's where the heroes step in. Or do they? This is the adventure that I ran at.
Go ahead.
Yeah, exactly. This is the adventure that I ran at Gen Con. I had a lot of success with it. And it has actually, if anybody gets it, played it at Gen Con, they're going to find it slightly different, and it is slightly different based on what happened in the games there. So I feel it's a improved based on the rigorous playtesting that it got at Gen Con.
So playtesting makes a difference. I always like to hear that.
Now, how many times did you get to run it at Gen Con?
I only ran it 4 times.
How traumatic was that experience?
It was awesome. Oh, man, I can't tell you how good a feeling it was. Number one, Kismax wasn't out yet. I had thrown together a slapdash book called the Quick and Dirty Gen Con Edition, which had basically the rules. And the response that I got from people playing it was utterly fantastic. It did lead me to add a bunch of my gaming philosophy in the back in the session called The Play's the Thing. Because the one thing that I learned is that, and I knew this, but in thinking how the game succeeded, a lot of it succeeded on certain aspects of my gaming philosophy intertwined as they were with the rules of Kiss My Axe. And the big one, that's probably the most important thing to do to have a really good time with Kiss My Axe, is you tell your players, tell me, don't ask me. So don't ask me if there's a chair in the room that you want to bash over the guy's head. Just tell me there's a chair in the room and I'm using it to bash the guy's head. Don't ask me if there's a tree that you can climb. Tell me that there's a tree, and tell me that you're climbing it.
More in line with like the Viking philosophy.
Exactly, yeah. And see, one of the changes in combat between Sword War and Kiss My Axe is that in order to use, there's a specific quality called style under prowess, and prowess is all about combat. And style you can only use if you describe your actions cinematically. So you can't just say, I hit it with the sword. Sorry, dude. No, not good enough. It's, I jump over his head, land behind him, spin, and take his neck out. Okay, that's pretty fucking cinematic. I'm good with that roll. So it's a quality, so it gives you a modifier. But also, in the system, if you score a critical success, it's 2d10 against the target number. So if you roll double zeros, a critical success, you get a free quality. You get a free what's called a stunt.
Yeah, that's the thing I liked about the Kiss My Axe rules, because first of all, in that section, it says you can only use style if things are poetically described. So yeah. It's like you can't just say I hit him with my sword in the head. There's more to it than that. But then to have the effects stack like that, where you can only have a stunt if you're using style, that's pretty cool.
Yes. And it gives a mechanical reason to use it, because I'm not going to force anyone to. So, I mean, if you don't want to pump ranks into style, you don't have to. And then, but there's a strong mechanical advantage to using it in combat, which brings the cinematic and the style into the combat. And then if you remind people, don't ask, just tell, then that level of cinematic action and excitement can be extended outside of combat.
Yeah, I think that's a really cool... almost like the Rosetta Stone for guys going from D20 over to a more narrativist system. This is how you make the jump. This is how, taking some narrative control helps your character, helps make the game more awesome. Because I found that can sometimes be a problem. Like taking guys from Mutants and Mastermind over to, something more fate-like, like Icons.
Mm-hmm, exactly. And, I mean, if you're going to even go further into story games... this is a nice little bridge, kind of like Icons or Fate, you might say, is also a bridge whereby there's not ultimate narrative control. It's not, as Chris from The Exile Survivors would call it, past the stick. But it does give a large amount of narrative control to the players to do whatever they need to do to make the game awesome for them. It also helps in that the impetus is no longer on the GM to be the provider of the spotlight. It's still a very important role for you as the GM to make sure that everyone gets their chance to shine. But it also puts a lot of that into the hands of the players, where they can say, I know this is something that my character should shine at, and I've got the tools that I need to basically map it out to be as awesome as I want.
So cool. Speaking of tools, when are we going to get the MP3 pronunciation guide for this?
Yeah, when I get one. Dude, I can write it out, but there's no way I can say half this shit.
Yeah, because some of the Norse pronunciations and stuff like that, I mean, you know, the only prior exposure to that I had was, you know, Thor's hammer, and I think I was saying that wrong for like 20 years.
Yeah, exactly.
The Scandinavian languages kind of fool you. I mean, it's all English characters when it doesn't really sound the way it should. But can I tell you guys a funny story about Norway?
Get it.
I was actually hired to work as a scout counselor at a Norwegian scout camp. And they're co-ed there, by the way.
Ooh.
For one summer back in the 90s. Yeah, yeah. And the thing is, 2 weeks beforehand, it was a big national jamboree, you know, like all the Norwegian scouts going to, you know, one place. But I had to spend 2 weeks in Oslo at the scout office. Literally, like, I was sleeping at the scout office before the jamboree kicked off. And the thing is, the scouts in Norway, like many other countries, aren't particularly well-funded. So they're in the low-rent district of Oslo.
Oh.
So I'm walking, you know, it's me. I go out and go drinking at night. I'm coming home, which in this case was the Oslo, you know, the Norwegian scout office, and there's these ladies on the street, and they're all yelling a word at me. I don't know what it means. They're all yelling, deep, deep. And I think perhaps I'm looking funny or I'm wearing the wrong kinds of clothes in this city. I do not know. Perhaps there's toilet paper upon my shoe. When I look, none of these things are true, so I just walk home. And later, I'm talking to my friends in the city. I'm like, so what does this mean when a woman looks at you and yells out the word deep? Is she offended? What? I go, oh, no, that means fuck. It turns out the Norwegian scout office is right smack in what passes for the red light district in Norway.
Wow.
Did you run back over there?
I live there, but
you got your badge?
I was a college student. I didn't have any money. And it was a little depressing because you talk to these girls, and most of them are heroin addicts. And it wasn't like Amsterdam where there's a whole regular red light district. This was just kind of, this is the two blocks where the police don't hassle you kind of thing.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, a little cross-cultural confusion there. But there was one guy at the scout camp, the guy who was running the event. And all the Norwegians, they kept saying he was undiluted. I didn't know what that meant. But apparently that's the word you use in Norway when you're describing someone who has, like, pure Viking blood. And it wasn't really an Aryan racial thing, because this guy looks like a Laplander. You know, swarthy skin, black hair. But Dude woke up at 5 a.m. every morning, and instead of showering, he walked to the lake and took a two-mile swim.
Jeez.
And, this is summer in Norway, which meant, and we were like 30 miles south of the Arctic Circle, so it was warm, but in the morning it was still below freezing. That dude was hardcore. He did not fuck around.
Like a polar bear.
Yeah, he was, that guy, he brooked no shit whatsoever. But,
I guess not.
Yeah, you got a lot of that in Norway. There was a lot of, anyway, not to ramble on. So, Kiss My Axe has been out for how long now?
Kiss My Axe has been out for just over a month.
Okay, how's it doing?
It's not doing as well as Sword Noir did, but I was expecting that. I think that Sword Noir sold as well as it did based on the novelty. There was nothing else out like it. I mean, the rules-wise, sure there was, because it's a mishmash of tons of different things. But the theme, the genre, I hadn't seen anything like that before, a mixture of sword and sorcery and hard-boiled fiction. So I think just on that novelty, it sold really well. I expected Kiss My Axe to sell less, and it's true, it has. It also cost less to make. I had in one of these great independent RPG company stories, I got in contact with an artist to do the art for it, and he kept stringing me along, answering my questions, but not actually showing me anything. When he finally showed me something, it was like, okay, but these are all... these are all portraits, and I've already got a bunch of portraits. And did you look at the art directions that I gave you? And I never heard from him again.
Oh.
So yeah. We went with – I was lucky because one of my players, Kieran O'Gorman, happens to be an artist. He's done a bunch of stuff in role-playing games as well as comics and that. And he had done a bunch of – when we were running our – role-playing our Viking True 20 game back before Kiss My Axe, he had done a bunch of portraits of the different NPCs that they had met. So I basically said, dude, I need to buy those off of you. And even more awesome than that was, I don't know if you guys know J.J. Lanza. He used to be part of Fistful of Comics and Games. But yeah. He and his two sons were at Gen Con. They were one of the guys that played it. And his eldest son, Giovanni, happens to be an artist. and Giovanni was doing a sketch during the game, and I saw him, and I said, dude, how would you like, you know, a paid commission? So we got him to do a bunch of art for the book as well. So, I mean, the art is the most expensive. Actually, the art and the layout are the two most biggest expenses for me because they're things I can't do. I can do layout, but it's not going to look awesome. I have Rob Wakefield is the guy who does my layouts and graphic design. He's also one of the Accidental Survivors. I pay him shit compared to what he should be getting, but it's still a, you know, it's an expense. And the art for Sword Noir was done by Ed Northcutt, who did just an absolutely fucking amazing job. Basically, it created two characters in Sword Noir that were that setting's version of Fafhrd and the Grey Mouser. And so I asked him to put them in different situations through the game or through the setting. And so he delivered those, and those looked absolutely awesome. And I was hoping to get something similar for Kiss My Axe, but because I didn't get an established artist. And Ed is another guy that he's done everything. Because I think I'm an established artist, the cost for the art wasn't there. So that was Kiss My Axe has a lower budget than Sword Noir. And if anybody's interested in all that, all the numbers are up at swordsandpublishing.ca. I try to follow the Evil Hat version of being open with all like the Fred Hicks basically tells all about all the sales. And yeah. I'm sorry?
No, I'm agreeing with you. Fred Hicks is a good model to follow because there are certain publishers who remain nameless who try to talk like they're, you know, fucking Penguin Publishing. Mm-hmm. And occasionally you talk to an artist at a convention and find out what the sales numbers really are. And you're like, oh, holy shit, really?
Mm-hmm.
So if Fred just puts it on the table, there's no pretense that, you know, hey, this is what's something different. This is exactly what we're selling. And I commend you. That's a great model to follow.
Well, actually, I think it's also useful for those people that might be thinking of self-publishing to look at Swords Edge Publishing. We've been in the business since 2004, since September of 2004, and you can look at our very first product. The product that got released in September 2004 has not yet broken 200.
I got to tell you, though, as a longtime fan myself of Swords Edge Publishing, Covert Forces, what a great book.
Now, this is
glad you like it. Just so happens you're one of the three people that it's dedicated to.
No, I understand. We were talking before the podcast, and Fraser was sending you some games to play while you were deployed in Iraq. Is that one of the modules you guys were playing?
Well, the thing is, you know, most people don't realize that when you're deployed, like, you know, they base their idea of what a deployment is on based off, like, different war movies that they see. So you don't realize that it's actually small, intense little action scenes punctuated by extreme vast amounts of boredom. So, you know, I'm sitting there one day and I'm like, you know, I'm missing all my episodes of Accidental Survivors and I have all this time. When I get home, I'm going to have virtually none because I'm going to have to jump back into a job, a life, you know. So I sent a note over to Fraser and I said, hey, you know, I'll pay you if you, you know, box up some MP3s and just send them over. He sent me all sorts of stuff. It was great. And let me tell you, the things that Fraser sent over to keep me occupied were constantly pilfered by some of my platoon mates. So, I mean, that was huge.
Oh, cool, cool. And what were you guys gaming while you were over there?
We did some Marvel Superheroes. We did like a Savage Fantasy kind of deal. And then while I was over there, I actually I managed to crank out some art for Chuck Rice. So, I mean, you know, I was trying to keep myself busy. But, you know, one of the things that made a long patrol really nice was, you know, we would have our CVCs, these big headsets, linked into a communication system. Well, one of our guys had an iPod that he linked into the system. And usually within an hour into the patrol, I was usually ready to throw myself off the end of the truck because it was nothing but country music. So, I mean, you know, 1 hour of that I can handle. 5 hours to 18 hours of that, I'm usually trying to eat the barrel of something I'm carrying. So, I mean, it's, you know, so to actually switch my own personal communications array over to, you know, 3 to 4 episodes of the Accidental Survivors, I was laughing my head off most of the time, so it was pretty cool.
Nice, nice. Yeah, I have a kind of stunted tolerance for country music myself.
It all depends on what it is. I mean, you know, if it's just like, you know, talking about cowboys and, you know, smacking cows in the ass, I mean, that's fun. You know, if it's talking about how, you know, their dog ran away with their girlfriend, it's just, I'm all set.
Yeah. You know, Hank Williams Jr. has a kid.
Does he really?
Yeah, Hank Williams III, and he's basically his whole career is giving the middle finger to Nashville. I've seen him a couple times in Denver. He's got a very unique audience, a very unique set. Like the first half of the night, he has a cowboy hat on. He just does straight old country covers, and there's all these cowboys, and it's Denver. We're a cow town, no matter how we pretend we're not. So you get all these guys from the plains coming out to listen, and then he says, "Folks, if you don't like hard, you know, old school punk, you want to leave right now." He takes the cowboy hat off, and he's got a mohawk.
That's awesome.
And the second half of the show, yeah, he gets no airplay, no radio play. He doesn't give a fuck. And, yeah, it's a good time. So if you see Hank III playing in town near you, do the right thing. Go check him out. But
All right,
cool. So I'm just amazed that guys, like, role play while they're on deployment. It just, I mean, from what you're saying, I mean, there's so much boredom, but, you know,
Well, one of the scariest things was, you know, when it was right about the time that we got there and that we were setting everything up. Our job over there was to establish, or help establish, the Iraqi Highway Patrol in our area. And yes, there are plenty of videos of the Iraqis doing what they're doing with the cop song on playing in the background. But you know, we won't go into that. One of the things that amazed me was you'd be on a 12-hour patrol. You'd get back, and people would throw their laptops into a circle, land them all together, and everybody would be playing Modern Warfare. And I'm just like, whoa. Wait, didn't you guys just do this?
Yeah, when I was working at Raytheon, one of my cube mate actually was he was a Marine intelligence officer, which is a joke that I don't need to expound on anymore. But
yep, I'm there with you.
They would most of his day when they weren't analyzing satellite pictures in San Diego, go kill these guys in this building. Was they were playing Warcraft, you know, on a little LAN they had set up there at the office. And then you know, kind of the punchline of that is one day, you know, that Marine officer walks in and says, "Hey, you," points at someone randomly. "You got it. We need an intelligence officer for a platoon. Throw on your boots and hey, you know, you got to go." But yeah, that's the nature of things. Hey, let me ask you a question, Walt.
Hit me.
Did Hurt Locker piss you off?
As a movie, I thought it was fun. As like an accurate depiction of, you know, the EOD and how they operate. Not my choice. You know, I mean, I've worked with those guys a couple of times. You know, and when I say work with, it's like, oh shit, there's a bomb here. Hey guys, can you come down here? And then we back off, and then they go in and do their thing. But always consummate professionals, always very prepared and ready to go and do their thing as safely as they can, you know, working within the confines of what they have to work with.
So is it true they're all also qualified snipers?
They don't have the time to handle that kind of thing. So when you see in the movie when he's sitting behind that berm and doing that whole thing, he's either been cross-trained or he's moved from another job in order to do that. And that's, like, a lot of people don't realize, you know, you can, like, right now, I'm a military police. I'm with the military police, but before that I was an infantryman. So, you know, while I know how to handcuff very poorly, you know, and you know, I can flick the light bar on a little cruiser, I'm much better with squad-based weaponry. So, I mean, your skills carry along, you know, when you go from one job to another. But yeah, when he dropped into that rifle and started you know, pulling shots at 500 meters, and there's no explanation of how or why he can do that. You know, I mean, I know that we didn't really work with the Army EOD a lot when I was over there. We were in an area heavily controlled by the Marines, so a lot of times it was Navy EOD that came out, and they always came out with SEALs. So I mean, it was. If they needed somebody shot, they would just sit there and go, "Hey, Frank."
Oh, man.
So I got a question for you, Walt.
Yeah,
up here in the Canadian Forces, the nickname I've heard of military police is Meathead. You get that in the South, yeah?
Usually it's cockmuncher, but yeah, you know, you cross international lines, I guess something gets lost in translation. They don't really like military police much in any of the forces, although that's starting to change now as the military police are more law enforcement for deployment zones rather than enforcement for military bases. a lot of the military bases are privatizing now.
Yeah, it's kind of sketchy. I'm not a big fan of private security firms. I haven't worked for a few of them.
Yeah, well, you know, you take what you can get, I guess.
Yeah, that's true. Hey, Canadian, just a random fact, there was a Tim Hortons open in Afghanistan.
Oh, yeah. Well, as soon as the Canadian forces were over there, we had to. There's a great picture. I actually work at National Defense Headquarters now, and there's a great picture of one of my cube mates who's a military guy. The first picture is a couple of very attractive Canadian forces soldiers with their Timmies, and then another picture is a bunch of guys like in a sandstorm, another Canadian force guy in a sandstorm, and then and the captions like Afghanistan, two different kinds of deployment.
Yep. Those are attractive female Timmies?
What's that?
Those were attractive female soldiers?
Yep.
Okay, just making sure.
There are some.
I wish we had those. Although I'm going to be careful because my wife works with me at the same unit and she's a good shot, so I'm going to retract that.
I wasn't just freaking female soldiers. My current girlfriend was in the military intelligence for the Army, which is another joke I don't need to expand on. So, yeah, I'm not saying anything bad about them.
So are we going to, speaking of all this warfare, are we going to get any, like, Viking warfare supplements for Kiss My Axe?
Well, here's the thing. With Sight for the Witch coming out now, I'm pretty much done. The cycle of production at Swordfish Publishing is wound down. I'm playtesting, just started a playtest for a new set of rules called Centurion, subtitled Legionaries of Rome. Yep. It's at very, very, very basic level right now. It's like a 12-page playtest document with the bare core rules, and if that turns out to be something that's really hot, I might try to pursue it. If I try to do anything more, it's probably going to be crowdfunded, or attempted to be crowdfunded. The second project that's in my head right now is also a version of the Sword's Edge system that I could plug into Covert Forces and do another Covert Forces release updated with its own rule set.
Right. Now, would all this be very similar to what you're releasing now, where it's got heavy elements of Fate and it's more story-driven than, say, rules-driven?
Yeah, the plan for, if I do, Centurion is very similar to the Sword's Edge system, which is the spine of Sword Noir and Kiss My Axe, but there's a very different dice mechanic on it. And also, it's very abstract. Instead of having things like physique and charisma, it has things like valor and duty and honor. And because they're supposed to be legionaries specifically, rather than just a Roman role-playing game, it's specifically legionaries. So these things are very important to the legions. And there's a very different dice mechanic. If I go forward with a covert forces version of the Sword Test system, the idea that I have for it, because I had a discussion with one of the other three that was Covert Forces was dedicated to, Bradley Clark, and when in our discussion about basically modern military game systems, he likes a very crunchy game, and I'm trying to find a way that I can have my cake and eat it too, because I really don't want to play a game that has more than 20 pages of mechanics. I'm old. I don't have a lot of time to read shit. Like, give it to me in a very concentrated burst. If you want to have like setting and examples and all this other stuff after that, that's great. Like, give me plenty of fluff. That's fine, because fluff is, I can take it or leave it. But if you can boil your rules down to 20 pages or less, I'm happy. And so that's what I'm trying to do with Covert Force. And I think probably the route that I'm thinking of taking is having some qualities that reflect training, so different types of training, and then have some qualities that actually reflect your equipment. In Kiss My Axe and Sword Noir and the Sword of System in general, equipment isn't important. You're assumed to have whatever you need, and if within reason you say, you know, well, I'm pretty sure that my barbarian would have an axe. Well, sure, yeah. I'm pretty sure my barbarian would have a chainsaw. Maybe not, no. But within reason, you've got whatever you want. The one thing with a modern military game is kit is really important. You have to have the right tool for the right job, and if you don't have it, you can be totally fucked.
So, and that's the thing, too. In a realistic military environment, you know, unless you have a Congress or some sort of parliament-funded specific money source that is dedicated to your unit, half the time you're dealing with second grade stuff that you can pretty much expect is going to break.
Yep. Yeah. So that's going to be another aspect. If that particular rule set goes forward, equipment's going to become a much more important aspect to it, and it's going to be qualities as well. So if you have the weapon that you love, that's actually going to be a quality. So these are ideas that I'm playing with for that one. But I think it would be a lot more closer to the Sword Judge system than what Centurion is, because Centurion's going with a totally different dice mechanic.
So if someone wants to get into the playtest for Centurion, so they drop you an email, or is that pretty much closed off, or how does that work?
No, it's totally open. They can drop me an email. I actually threw up a link to the document. I think it's expired now. I was using YouSendIt, which is one of these free sharing cloud things. But I think that link expired. But no, if anyone's interested, just let me know, and I can fire them a copy. It's like, I think it's 12 pages right now. But a lot of that, again, if you've read Kiss My Axe or Sword Noir or the Sword Hiss system, which is free, just go to RPG Now and download it. It's free. If you've read that, then the most of the rules you'll already know. Things like what a quality is, and a lot of the explanation of game terms and stuff like that. The thing that's going to be new are the specific types of qualities that, and also Centurion has a social mechanic. So things like your patron, which is extremely important, especially in Republican Rome and in the what they call the Principate, the early imperial period. Having a patron was extremely important, and your class, your like social class, was also very, very important. It was important to who can get into the army at any particular time. And then you've got a thing called auctoritas, which we usually translate as authority, but in actual Roman times, it was much more abstract. It was more like a charisma, influence, ability to get people to do things for you. So these are the social things that we don't. I mean, there's charisma in Kiss My Axe and in Sword Noir, but it doesn't have these kind of social qualities that Centurion has. But again, if anyone's interested, just fire it on. Just be aware. There's no setting. If you don't know anything about Roman history, there's nothing there that's going to help you out. It's, again, because it's very much just a mechanics playtest document. The main idea is to see if the dice mechanic, which is a little bit bizarre, will actually work.
Now, will different factions different social structures from Roman legionary life, will that show up? Like if you're, say, some sort of a commander, or if you were a slave that was conscripted, or if you, now, would these all be qualities? Like even being a Praetorian, would those be qualities or part of the rules themselves?
So, yeah, as it stands right now, other than social class, there's nothing that defines your character's level. So if you wanted to be, for example, a Praetorian, if you wanted to be a Centurion, if you wanted to be an Aquifier, if you wanted to be a Tribune, that's totally no problem. That's a narrative thing. Because what the bottom line is, your auctoritas. You can be a Tribune from a patrician family, but the centurion, the plebeian centurion, has more auctoritas than you. And for whatever reason, he might just be a very charismatic guy. He might be someone that's been doing a lot of favors for a lot of people and has a lot of pull in a lot of places that you don't. That sort of thing. So
like Mike Lafferty.
Yeah,
that's exactly.
I'm kind of the power behind the throne in a lot of RPG small press stuff you don't even know about. If books published or books being successful, it's probably because of me. I'm just...
And that's why it is the BAMF.
It's the BAMF! Sorry, that's the wine talking, forget it.
I might want to switch to a new box.
If I finish this one, I'll probably be going out and picking random fights with, like, you know, I can't really go out and pick random fights in the neighborhood I live in because there's a cop station, like, one block away, so.
That'd be an interesting fight to pick.
Yeah, I would lose that fight. I'm not ashamed to say, especially in my current condition. But that's not Mike and his drinking problem. All right, so we've covered Kiss My Ass, covered Suffer the Witch. We've talked about various other things. And I've gotten close to the point where I know Walt has to leave for work tonight. So is there anything else we want to cover before we call the podcast tonight?
Everybody go out and buy Sword Noir and Kiss My Ass.
That would be nice.
Buy Quick Kiss My Ass. If you just kiss my ass. happen at some point in this podcast.
It was intentional. that's why I was named that.
After three glasses of wine, it happens. You can get the Sword Noir rules for free at RPG Now, so you have no excuse. It's an excellent system. It's rules light, plays fast. It's a lot of fun. Check it out. Got a couple adventures. Hell, there's a series of short stories called The Simple Coin for just $1.99. You can check out, kind of get the flavor. There's the whole bundle for Sword Noir, the whole goddamn shooting match is $5.77. What the fuck? $5.77? What's wrong with you? That's like a large drink at Starbucks.
The one thing about Kiss Max and actually about Sword Noir as well that should be evident to anybody that reads the Sword Edge system, the free stuff, is that magic doesn't play like it usually plays in most fantasy things. Magic in both is very difficult. If you want to do it well, you're going to be paying a lot of ranks, meaning you're going to be very focused in that and not focused in other things. And it's not combat magic. So if you're planning to use it in combat, it's really not going to work. And the reason for that is very much based on the source material. In Sword and Sorcery, in general, except for like Elric and a few others, most of the magic is in the hands of the bad guys or in the hands of people that are supporting the main characters. And in Viking society, magic was pretty much considered feminine. There was a specific kind of it was basically a poetic version. You had to have a 7-line stanza to cast your magic kind of thing that was acceptable among men, but most of the magic was incredibly feminine. So again, in the Norse sagas, you really don't have heroes who are wizards. So, but again, because in general it's fantasy role-playing games, and most people, not most people, but there is a certain aspect of the market that will not play a game if they can't use magic, it's in there.
And like I was talking about that once on an interview, he's talking about how, I've seen this before, he's more interested in writing rules for magic as a GM, he kind of favors magic users. And he was talking about how that's kind of a discrepancy, but or maybe a bias among, you know, the dungeon masters, but interesting stuff. Hey, random Norwegian Viking story. When I was at that camp in Norway, I ran into some Laplander pagans who wanted to cast my runes. And we were working a little bit because it's like that at Norwegian scout camps. I'm talking to these girls, and they were getting along pretty well, and they got these runes, and they're casting them, and I'm like, well, this is really cool. Did you guys carve these runes yourself out of maybe reindeer bone or something? They're like, oh, no, we bought this at a mall in Oslo. Just kind of killed my whole investment in the
magic runes from the mall in Oslo.
Yeah, you're looking for something a lot deeper as a tourist. You want something transcendent. Like, oh, no, we have malls here, too. Oh, fuck, okay. Still in Western civilization, aren't I, motherfuckers? Okay, that's fine.
Interesting note, though, but back in the actual Viking Age, it was the Finns and the Laplanders who were considered to be the main sorcerers. So a lot of the times when you, in the Norse mythology and the Norse sagas, when you meet the sorceress or the witch or whatever, they tend to be Finns. And it was actually a male Finn or Lapland, actually a male foreigner in general. If you were a Norse, if you were Scandinavian and a wizard, like, you'd be burned alive. But if you were a foreigner, and in general it was the Finns, it was acceptable for you to be a sorcerer. And they would cross-dress because, again, magic was feminine. Very just weird.
Interesting. Do you know Finnish is actually closer to Hungarian than it is to Scandinavian languages?
Yes, much closer to Magyar, which
kinda,
is weird.
Yeah, it's kind of weird because, I mean, the Norwegians, the Danes, the Swedes all kind of understand each other. It's just sort of, I mean, it's like going from Indiana or, you know, Michigan down to, you know, Georgia. It's the same language, but there's a lot of differences. But, yeah, it's, you go to Finland and everything's fucking different. So, yeah.
If you go back, like, to the 8th and 9th century, the language that evolved, like, basically the time of Old Norse, was still understandable to Germanic speakers because it came to the same root.
No, I understand. I could catch a lot of Norwegian just because I, for like 8 years of German between high school and college.
Yeah.
Try to speak German, they get pissed. It happened in the 30s and 40s, they're still a little sensitive about. Yeah, it's
a good
deal. Yeah, they, especially if you're a 6 foot tall blonde dude speaking German in Oslo, they it's a thing. You get some looks. I'm just saying. There's a reason Norway isn't in the EU, and it's motherfucking Germany. Yeah, that's just what it comes down to. Hey guys, you mind if I pimp something here?
Hit it. Go to it.
All right. I am running Kickstarter. to do a series of Icons adventures called Improbable Tales. If you go to Kickstarter.com and just, you know, search for Improbable Tales, it's me. I'm doing a series of 5 adventures, 4 icons. If we meet our goal of $400, we unlock a 6th adventure, you know, for free. And right now we're at $333. We're just $67 away from hitting our goal. So
ooh,
you could be a big hero right now. Just jump on and, you know, kick in $15-$20. And we're almost there. And we've got a discussion in the comments section about what kind of what's the 6th adventure going to be. That'll be voted on by contributors, blah, blah, blah. If you got a good idea, let's throw it out there. Then we can vote on it. Right now, all we're talking about is Mecha and Kaiju, which is cool, don't get me wrong, but I'd like to have at least have one other alternative to vote on. So, anyway.
What's the end date for that?
We just started. We got 80% of our goal within the first 3 days. Right now,
nice.
We are 33 days away. So it's, I think I want to say it's February 17th or 18th. I tried to go from one middle weekend to the next middle weekend because the middle weekend of the month is where everyone has a paycheck that's not being used.
Yeah. And, you know, the art on all the covers and stuff like that is gorgeous.
Yeah, that's my man, Adrian Smith, British guy. And also Dan Houser kicked in a couple of them. God bless him, Dan Houser. He's a prince among men and has a fine singing voice. So, yeah, if you get a chance, please check it out. We're just, you know, we're going for fun, light, you know, fast adventures, you know, kind of casual play, which I think is where the whole role-playing game hobby is heading, except for the few folks who are into, you know, Hero. So, anyway, I am done pimping because I have carpal tunnel and pimp hand gets hard quickly. So,
well, the good thing is that I think they released a bunch of statistics, and if a Kickstarter hit like 30% or 35%, it was like the vast majority of them then get funded.
You know, Fraser, I hear you. I'm just a little neurotic. I worry that maybe I just have exactly $333 of goodwill out there on the internet, and maybe I'm frozen there.
But also, a lot of them do finish strong. So I mean, like a lot of them have in the last few days, people tend to, some that's close to being funded, they usually get funded even in the last few days. So you got a lot of time.
Look at the Far West Kickstarter.
Oh, yeah, or Pilgrims of the Flying Temple. That's, you know, it's. I really think that for some of our niche hobbies like comics and especially role-playing games, I think we're going to be seeing more and more Kickstarter programs just because the market's hard to predict, and the Kickstarter is a good way of saying, hey, are you guys interested in this? Instead of just, you know, making it on your own and throwing it out to the public. So I think we're going to see more and more of that as time goes on.
It's just too bad it wasn't wider because as a Canadian, I can't use Kickstarter.
I really wish you could. I'm sorry. I was going to use Indiegogo, but everyone just says, why don't you choose Kickstarter? Of course, everyone in this case is Americans, and I'm sorry. Yeah. But yeah, no, you have a good...
No, I can buy into Kickstarter, but if I want to do Centurion, if I want to crowdfund Centurion, I can't do it through Kickstarter.
Yeah.
So, I mean, in that case, we'd just use Indiegogo, and if people said, you should use Kickstarter, I'd say, well, then make Kickstarter. Let me use it, and I will.
Yeah. Well, you know, if you want, I'll open a Kickstarter account for you and send all the money over, but yeah, it's weird. And I want to be nice to you Canadians because someday it's going to be someone elected down here who's going to make me want to move north. So I want to have plenty of friends up there when that happens.
You're all welcome up here. Don't you worry.
Well, I read a German article recently in Spiegel where the author was basically describing, you know, American primary elections as a form of European amusement. And I was like, yeah, it's probably that way for the Canadians and the Mexicans too. So, yeah.
No, our election is the same thing, and the person writing in Der Spiegel obviously hasn't followed German elections either, because they're all exactly the same. There's no. Well, I used to live in South Korea, and the associate dean of the college that I worked at was this great, great guy. He was an ex-army chaplain. He'd been in Vietnam, Korean guy, of course, but he'd been in Vietnam and everything. Exactly the image you would expect of like a retired minister kind of thing. And in one of our discussions, he was like, I do not like South Korean politicians. They are dirty. And I'm like, no, sir, that's actually wrong. What you want to say is, I don't like politicians. They are dirty. Not just South Koreans.
It transcends, you know, language and cultural boundaries. The Germans are very angry, though. It's suppressed anger because they're Germans. So it comes out in different ways. And the article might have been one of them. But, yeah. It's interesting place, Germany. I didn't spend enough time there, but I'll go back one day when I'm dodging, you know, charges or something. But
Another variant to Interpol, so you don't want to go there. Try Portugal.
Portugal. I'll just move back to Galloway Bay, Ireland, where like every third guy's named Lafferty, and just hide out.
And no one will know.
Yeah. Which Lafferty are you looking for? The guy with the American accent. Oh, well. Hey, all right, so we're coming up on the one-hour mark, and I know Walt has to leave for work soon, so we should probably be wrapping things up. Anything else you want to cover, pimp, extrapolate on before we call it a podcast?
It's all good.
All good.
All right, everybody's happy. All right, guys, thanks for your time. And listeners, I am very grateful for your time and your downloads and, you know, just being who you are, man. You're special. If I, if I was there right now, I'd give you a hug, a big bear hug, but I wouldn't linger too long. Cause it was kind of... So thanks a lot, and catch us next time on the BAMP Podcast.